Hello, my name is Nicholas Ward, and this is Historical Hysteria, the only show that is going to get me abducted by the CIA. Today, we are talking about torture. And no, I'm not just referring to listening to this show. For millennia, espionage and counter-espionage has tried to get and hide information. And through all of that time, as everyone knows, torture has been the first resort of the wicked and the last resort of the good. Because of how much torturing the CIA did post-9/11, torture is one of those things that Americans talked about a lot in the 2010s, then pretty much collectively forgot, like, say, the Jonas Brothers. The common defense of torture is they're bad people and we are doing it to save lives. The common criticism of torture is it doesn't work because people will say anything to make it stop. Criticisms of torture often begin and end at torture for confessions. You can't torture a confession out of people because it's not reliable, because people will say anything to make torture stop eventually. But that doesn't answer the question, can torture be used to get information out of people? American pop culture has taken a surprisingly strong stance on this, that yes, you can, but you shouldn't. Unless you're the good guys. And American TV and movies is filled with examples of the evil necessity of torture, from Mr. 24 blowing off terrorists' kneecaps, to weirdly comedies like Chuck taking the line, "People always talk." Even our funny spectacle cinema of bright lights and bad dialogue almost inevitably involves the good guy finding a puzzle they can't solve, then solving it by just punching someone repeatedly in the face in a kind of Mickey Mouse torture scene. Everyone probably remembers that scene in Batman where the bad guy won't reveal a hideout. So Batman drops him off a roof and breaks both his legs, and then he reveals the location of the hideout because, yeah, of course, that makes sense. Well, to cut this episode short, torture just doesn't work, and it never has. And it's not really a situation of sometimes or only in these circumstances. No, in fact, torture, at least torture as you and I know it, is a myth. It really doesn't exist. So what is torture? This episode will be delving into what torture is, why it is used, and how, in some ways, our entire modern justice system is inextricably linked with it. This will be a two-part episode, and the second episode will delve into the sexier side of torture. Torture for information. Beaten on terrorists to find out where those bombs are. But you'll have to wait for that one. Now, I want to start by saying, don't worry. I'm not making these bold statements, then just presenting my stupid opinion with some straw man logic traps about how torture works as though that's evidence. I've never been tortured, and I've also never tortured anyone, except emotionally, and by making them listen to this show. But believe it or not, the CIA did not invent torture after 2001. A history of torture is a history inextricably linked to oppression, punishment, religion, and the justice system. But above all else, a history of torture is a history of people lying. In today's episode, we are going to take a brief tour through the history of torture for confessions and torture for punishment. Next episode, we'll talk more about torture for information. Torture. What is it? What is it used for? What's torture's deal? So let's jump in our time machines and strap ourselves to the rack of knowledge and stretch our minds as far as I am stretching this metaphor. There are three main types of torture through history: torture through punishment, torture for confessions, and torture for information. There are also forms of torture for pleasure and sexual gratification, but let's just steer well clear of that, because the Marquis de Sade is giving me a weird look and I do not want to deal with that right now. No, no! No means no, Desaad. Go away. Torture has existed in all recorded history and probably stretches far back into prehistory. At its very basics, torture is deliberately inflicting severe pain over an extended period of time. It's been implemented by individuals, groups, and states. Torture for punishment is pretty self-explanatory. I don't like you, you did X, so I'm going to hurt you really, really badly. That form of torture isn't a myth, and it definitely works if your goal is hurting someone or making them miserable. So though that type of torture is grimly fascinating, it isn't what I'm going to be dealing with today. Splitting people in half and leaving them to starve to death or removing all of their limbs was more of a public spectacle about scaring people into submission. And unfortunately, of all the forms of torture, its use as a tool of terror was pretty effective. The most famous torturer's tool of terror was arguably the crucifix. A horrific way to die, the crucifix was a brutal tool for breaking even the strongest of rebels and incentivizing order. Taking a bold revolutionary, strapping them to a cross, then leaving them to die of dehydration over days till they were raving mad, covered in their own excrement, was a powerful way of breaking people and demystifying martyrs. Crucifying was also used as an incentive for people to move towards Roman citizenship. Roman citizens were immune from crucifixion as a punishment. But today, most non-sociopaths understand why these things are things we shouldn't do. It falls into the same historical category as child marriages, rampant political assassinations, and forcing people into ghettos. I hope most people regard those things with aversion, but you never really know what the rich are thinking at any given moment. But anyway, moving past torture as a tool of terror, states have integrated torture into their justice systems since the first justice systems as a means of punishment, terror, confessions, and interrogation. Torture, in various forms, existed in pretty much all recorded societies and was usually but not always reserved as a special punishment for crimes considered especially bad. Either torturing someone for a long time or simply to death, like a crucifixion. States would often use torture as a proverbial stick. The Code of Hammurabi doesn't have torture per se as a capital punishment, but some of its methods of execution are essentially just torturing someone to death, like throwing a person in a fire. The classical Romans had crucifixion, the Vietnamese had fast-growing bamboo, and the industrial slavers used hot boxes, and the CIA used water. States like Rome had graded systems of torture and punishment. Crucifixion and other really brutal tortures were reserved for non-Roman citizens as both an incentive and a threat to ensure loyalty to the empire. Now, like with many barbarities from the past, most people have no problem seeing torture as a punishment as wrong. As far as it goes, it is also the most effective form of torture because it does exactly what it advertises. It hurts people to punish them. This kind of dramatic and often horrific punishment is still used by various ruthless states and groups to this day. The second type of torture, torture for confessions, is as old as history. Are you a rebel? No? Bear in mind, I'm going to pull out your intestines, and then I'm probably going to kill you anyway, slowly and horrifically for wasting my time. So I will ask you again, are you a rebel? And if you say yes, I might imprison you, but more likely I'll just give you a quick death. Quick time traveler's tip, if you are ever thrown back in time and someone accuses you of being a witch or a heretic, often your best chance at survival was confession. Resisting often meant torture, then execution. If you confessed, sometimes you were just imprisoned. Torture for confessions isn't exactly hard for people to understand as being ineffective and or immoral, but it's also the form of torture possibly the most misunderstood. Through history, torturing confessions out of people is sometimes presented as simply being a formality to get a confession from people already condemned to death as traitors or heretics. And it was often that. But torturing confessions out of people has a far longer, deeper, and more insidious history that stretches through till today. Once humans stopped living in villages of a few hundred people, crime became a very complex problem. Codified laws simplified this and tried to stop vigilantism and blood feuds of tribal societies, but there were some obvious questions about justice. An eye for an eye is the most famous punishment in the Code of Hammurabi. If you take someone's eye in a fight or by accident, they get to take your eye. Or the less famous part is you can pay compensation, which meant the rich were never really punished like the poor were. Easy, but what if there were no witnesses, but the accused and the victim? And what if the accused says, "The victim was just trying to scare money out of me"? What if a murder occurs and there are no witnesses, but everyone kind of knows who did it because there was one person who benefited from it and, you know, was really obviously a murderer? What if someone steals someone's money in full view of others, but has witnesses ready to take the stand saying it couldn't possibly have been them? In the modern world, we have all sorts of criminology, which are all kind of a bit suspect, and we've gone into that in a previous episode. But nevertheless, we have things like digital records, private eyes, police, detectives, private security companies, and even amateur sleuths who can assemble really quite compelling evidence and make a case. Even without direct evidence, enough circumstantial evidence can be damning. All right, no one saw you kill your friend and take their money, but we have a deposit slip for the exact amount stolen the next day from your bank. You can't tell us where you got that money. You were spotted in the area by security cameras, and an investigation of the notes turned up your DNA and the victim's DNA on the notes. That would be pretty conclusive evidence. But for 99% of human history, none of these things existed. Parables spring up across the world explaining how wise judges found right from wrong, like cutting a baby in half to see which mother loves it enough to abandon it. Anyway, if you think about it for more than 2 seconds, you realize in the vast majority of... But if you think about it for more than 2 seconds, you realize in the vast majority of criminal cases, it would have just been he said, she said. That's still what most legal issues are, and even with all our modern technology, it is almost impossible to try cases like that today without evidence. So even with all our fancy codes, how did the Code of Hammurabi, or Dane Law, or the Constitution of Athens, or any number of ancient legal systems deal with cases where there was no real evidence? The answer was often judicial torture. Judicial torture sounds like sitting in a courtroom for 6 hours waiting to be heard, but it had a simpler role. Torture one or both people, the one telling the truth will stick to it. Judicial torture is the pulling the fingernails out until the person admits they are a heretic trope. And to be fair, it was and still is used to kill people who are annoying or inconvenient when you need an excuse. Because even brutal tyrants like having excuses. But judicial torture had a much larger and weirdly egalitarian role throughout history. Many societies decided in complex cases the best case was to torture everyone involved for a confession. The idea was that the person telling the truth would hold out longer, and then whoever was lying wouldn't and could be punished accordingly. Not everyone involved was always tortured. The accused, not the accuser, was more likely to be tortured, and this became a certainty if they were accused by someone in authority or in a higher social class than them. But wait, I hear you saying, how does this make any sense? Well, I'm glad you asked, because it gives me the chance to talk about Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Spoiler alert, the book opens on a young nihilist who kills his landlady just to see her die. It is a brilliant, but heavy-handed, morality tale about how nihilism means killing little old ladies to prove you believe in nothing, and that believing in nothing is inherently evil. It's about as nuanced a portrayal of nihilism as the nihilist in The Big Lebowski. You know, the ones all in leather who say, "We believe in nothing, Lebowski," and chase him around his dream with big scissors. The book follows the young man as he buries evidence and avoids a savvy police detective. The book follows him as he goes through a transformation of guilt. The culmination of the story has him confronting the police detective about the murder, who replies, "Well, it's obvious who the murderer is. It's you. I'm just waiting for you to confess." The young man eventually confesses, despite there being no real evidence against him. He is then sent to Siberia and released as a model prisoner to live out happily with his sex prize. The book is a lot better than I'm making it sound. It's one of the classics of literature, but the concept is exploring the guilty conscience of a murderer. And the main arc of the book is a story full of religious subtext, easily lost on a modern audience. Dostoevsky was a committed Orthodox Christian, and his books were often about moral decay in society. The central plot point of the book resolving with the young man confessing is brilliant and believable story work, because you've just spent the last 300 pages reading about his guilty conscience and the burning fear and self-loathing he feels. And it's more than just a guilty conscience, because Dostoevsky wasn't getting this idea from nowhere. He was writing about the very foundation of the Russian justice system and justice systems all over Europe. The guilty soul will confess. In Christian Europe, the idea evolved that the easiest way to find out guilt or innocence was to let God resolve it. Unfortunately, God is remarkably reticent about getting involved on earth, so an idea was born that God gives strength to the innocent and weakens the guilty. a guilty conscience was sometimes said to be the voice of God. In Crime and Punishment, the protagonist is being tortured by the voice of God, and confessing and going to prison liberates him. And this was what judicial torture was based on, the idea that if you were innocent, God gave you the strength to endure, and if you were guilty, he took it away. Not everyone believed torture was necessary for this, though. Dostoevsky, even though he seems like a religious fundamentalist today, in 19th century Russia, he was a humanist, and his view was that conscience would cause guilt to come forward, with or without torture, and was popular with humanist philosophers at the time. But it doesn't take a genius to see the flaw with that, does it? There are plenty of murderers, rapists, and thieves who sleep pretty soundly. How many participants in the Holocaust turned themselves in? Some of them were still committed Nazis, even in their 90s, even with everything that they did. How does that work? Do we only punish people who feel bad about their crimes? A lot of serial killers have been pretty adamant about not feeling bad about their crimes. So it may come as a surprise that this idea that God will give you strength is kind of still the entire basis of not just the Western European legal system, but most functioning legal systems on the planet. See, just as Europeans were saying God gives strength to the innocent, similar ideas were springing up in just about every country and region on the planet. Either God or righteousness was said to resolve these matters. It doesn't matter whether it was God or righteousness, it's the same concept and it had the same conclusion. The most famous of these kind of trials were trials by combat and trials by ordeal, where disputes would be resolved either by fighting or by various ordeals like holding a burning hot iron or plunging your hand into boiling water. My favourite trial by combat was for marital disputes in Germany, where they would dig a hole and put the husband in it with a club. The wife would then circle the hole with a bag of rocks, pelting him while he tried to hit her with the club. Also, probably the stupidest of the trials of ordeals also came from Germany. It was called Cruination, and it was a trial for accused murderers based on a belief that a corpse spontaneously bled if brought near the person who killed them. Which, no. Failing these trials was seen as proof of guilt. However, for various reasons, trials by ordeal weren't always possible or desirable. But how do you get a conviction in an era before reliable proof? Well, for all but the most cut and dry cases, there was only the one method. Confessions. Unlike Dostoevsky, justice systems throughout the world often thought that the guilty mind needed a bit of a nudge. But judicial torture wasn't always as barbaric as it sounds. Don't get me wrong, it was barbaric. But take the Inquisition. Following some bad press after the Cathar heresy, the Inquisition developed some of the most stringent torture restrictions among justices in Europe. Torture was limited to a set amount of time and wasn't allowed to pierce the skin. If you could resist the set torture, you're all good, terms and conditions apply. Depending on what crime you were accused of and what time period, it was often better to be tried by the Inquisition than by local authorities, though this heavily depended on a number of factors, and I don't want it to sound like the Inquisition wasn't still monstrous. Now, resisting judicial torture was sometimes considered evidence in favour of your innocence, but even when it wasn't, if you didn't confess, it was almost impossible to fairly convict anybody of anything. This idea of a confession being tantamount to everything is still relevant because of that, and it is why law enforcement still tries so hard to get confessions, because when people don't confess, convicting them can be really difficult. Once judicial torture began to be phased out, courts began to realize a simple truth that had underpinned thousands of years of judicial practice. Convicting people is almost impossible. Even in the modern world, with all our fancy tech, it is still incredibly difficult to convict people without them. Think about any murder mystery show. How do they all resolve? You've got Psych or Monk or, you know, crime dramas like, well, crime comedies like Suits or Poirot or Miss Marple or any one of 100 different murder mysteries. How do they always end? They always end with the brilliant detective coming out and laying out a perfect reconstruction of the crime and the murderer confessing. Watch him back. Watch back Poirot. I love Poirot. But at the end of almost every Poirot, the murderer confesses. It's very rare in a murder mystery that the murderer doesn't confess. And if you think about it, they kind of have to. Because so often, if you think about what the detective is saying, it is complete conjecture. And, you know, all they'd have to do is be like, nah. How do you convict them then? So often, the brilliant detective, the reason the brilliant detective is the only one who can solve them is because there's no other evidence. And then it's just, I, with my brilliant mind, deducted this. And is that evidence in a court? I'm so brilliant, I deducted this because you were writing weirdly with your left hand. And as we've touched on in a previous episode, criminal investigations are really, really difficult. And oftentimes they hinge on really arbitrary and often completely inconsequential evidence because someone just managed to convince a jury that it was consequential. And other times, it's the opposite. Think of the O.J. Simpson trial. So even in our modern world, with all our fancy tech, it's really, really difficult to convict people without a confession. And justice systems are almost totally reliant on them. And if you think I'm exaggerating, let me introduce you to the Japanese justice system that has an impressive 99% conviction rate. How? Confessions. Virtually no one goes to trial in Japan, and the Japanese police will use some very creative methods to get you to confess. Like with foreigners, where they have in the past handed them forms in Japanese and said, sign this and you can go home. And then you're convicted because you signed a confession. And their justice system doesn't care that you didn't know what it said. If you think the West is better, it's almost impossible to recant a confession in the United States. And police have been caught feeding information to confessees to get them to make more convincing confessions. Like saying no over and over again as a person tries to confess till they make a convincing confession. Police have also found creative non-torture torture forms, like isolating people for days while breaking them down mentally and actively lying to them. And if all else fails, you can always just threaten to throw the book at them if they refuse to confess and take a plea. And while we don't torture people anymore, what's that? The Chicago police were caught torturing people. Solitary confinement is torture. People can be kept for questioning for 48 hours. Okay, well, while we don't pull people's fingernails out anymore, arguably judicial torture and confessions are still deeply embedded in modern justice because we can't convict people without them. And that's where the myth I mentioned at the beginning of the episode comes in, because though in history torture was used as punishment and for confessions, it wasn't used how we today conceive of torture. Ecclesiastical and civil authorities, to their credit, actually did occasionally try to reduce the harmful effects of torture. Judicial torture was both the most common form of torture through history and completely antithetical to our modern idea of torture, and often had deeply spiritual meaning to those involved, who weirdly would sometimes submit themselves willingly to being tortured. But that's not to say judicial torture was good, or that it worked. If 10,000 years of history shows us anything, it's that a judicial system built on the idea that the guilty will confess is far too open to and encouraging of abuse, even to today. That is all we have time for today. Thank you for joining me. Next week, we are tackling the big question, torturing people for information. And we will be getting into the nitty-gritty of torture, going into the individual stories. This week was more of a broad overview of torture and what torture meant in a judicial sense. Next week, we will be going into the actual stories of individuals tortured for information. Feedback can be sent, as always, to historicalhysteria@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out the socials r/historicalhysteria on Reddit and @manichistory on Twitter. But before I leave, let me leave you with this. The word pizzazz, though sounding vaguely old and vaguely Italian, is in fact a brand new English word and one of the few completely indigenous words to English. The first concrete recorded instance of the word pizzazz was in 1937 in Harper's Bazaar. In March, it was written, pizzazz, to quote the editor of the Harvard Lampoon, is an indefinable dynamic quality, the je ne sais quoi of function. As, for instance, adding scotch puts pizzazz into a drink. Certain clothes have it too. Now that obviously indicates that the word pizzazz was used in the Harvard Lampoon, and there are some earlier usages which may have the word pizzazz in them, but 1937 is the first concrete use of the modern term pizzazz to mean something energetic and exciting. Anyway, bye.